Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests tonight are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and from Washington, D.C., Libby Casey of APRN. Paul, a second Anchorage police officer, is hospitalized. A suspect was found, followed, and that suspect is now dead. Quite a story.
Quite a story. One that we're seeing too often nowadays, I'm afraid. Officer Gene Mills was shot at about 3:15 a.m. In the arm and in the hip as she tried to make a routine traffic stop. Police began looking for a 24-year-old man, Kenneth Alonzo Santos Robinson, who's got a long history of with the criminal justice system dating back to when he was 7 years old. When confronted by the police, they had him under surveillance. When confronted, he walked towards them apparently and withdrew the same 40 caliber gun that he used to shoot the police officer and shot himself to death. And it's one of those tragic things. We have a police officer now in the hospital probably for a good long time, and a young man dead.
Steve, what do we know about the suspect beyond what Paul has just told us?
Yeah, well, he's been in trouble, according to what the police have told us. He's been in trouble basically in the juvenile system since he's about 7 years old, spent most of his adult life in jail, and was allegedly involved in a drug sale when Officer Mills happened on him, and he supposedly told friends he's not going to go back to jail. He just wasn't going to do that. So he's also the grandson of Alonzo Patterson, Reverend Alonzo Patterson, who's the pastor over at Shiloh Baptist Church, who's a wonderful man who's done a lot for the community, done a lot for the state.
And is well known in the community.
Well known in the community. Just a great guy. He's counseled his grandson over the years. He was in contact with him, or at least the grandson was in contact with Reverend Patterson during this latest episode. And Reverend Patterson told the Daily News that he felt he could have brought his grandson through this alive, unscathed, had he been able to go to the scene and converse with him, communicate with him. Hard to know that. He sounded like a real desperate young man in all of this. Highly tense situation, middle of the night, police officers surrounding this house. They know this fellow's arm. They know this fellow's desperate. Then this young man allegedly had already shot another police officer. So a pretty tense situation. And I'm sure officers were thinking, do we want to put a civilian in this situation? So,
Paul, there will be an official report because there is a fatality in this.
Surely there will.
And do you have any idea how long something like that takes?
No, I don't. And I think it varies on the circumstances. This young man had just gotten out of Spring Creek Correctional. He was being sought for malicious destruction of property and perhaps robbery, talking about not wanting to go back to prison. Mm-hmm. These kind of reports, they can be open and shut and done in a week or two because it has to be reviewed by everybody up and down, legal, superiors, supervisors, and then some take quite a while.
Okay, thank you. Let's get Libby Casey in here. Libby, Senator Lisa Murkowski's legislation that would have put some controls, in her judgment, or limitations on the EPA, finally got to the Senate floor. It was an unusual piece of legislation, and unusual that a member of the minority could get something like this to the floor. But she wanted a vote. First, tell us about the legislation and what happened.
That's right. Well, the Environmental Protection Agency is set to start regulating greenhouse gases from stationary, non-moving sources, and that is factories and power plants and the like. And Senator Murkowski says that will mean standards put on businesses that will cost them money and be burdensome. She says it should be up to Congress, not the feds, to set those emission standards. Now, the EPA has said it will move slowly and that it's just reacting to a Supreme Court decision that said you have to move forward on this. And many Democrats in the Senate agree with Murkowski that Congress should make the rules. Now, it's, of course, a big surprise when members of Congress say they know what's best, right? But they don't like her approach. Senator Murkowski used this rare disapproval resolution to fight the EPA, and yesterday there were about 6 hours of debate on the Senate floor, which actually was very interesting and ranged in topic from the BP spill blowout to concerns by a Wyoming senator that the EPA would start regulating the carbon dioxide that you and I breathe out, which is not likely to happen. In the end, Murkowski's push failed, and she did get 6 Democrats on board, but that wasn't enough. And Senator Begich did not support it. He's in the camp that says something should be done about the EPA and its power, but he wants to see Congress tackle broader overall energy and climate change legislation. And his reasoning is, why take the wind out of Congress's sails to get something done? Roll it into a bigger action and start moving on things like renewables. Now here's the next shoe to drop, Michael, is what this means for climate change legislation. Does yesterday's vote give us any indication of what could happen this summer and that? And questions are swirling around whether Democrats would have enough votes to move forward. We don't know yet if they'd have the needed 60 votes. This isn't the last we'll see about EPA discussions, though. West Virginia Democrat Jay Rockefeller has another bill relating to this, and Murkowski says she's not going to give up.
I wonder, do you suppose that there were Democrats who voted with Murkowski, and that was impressive that she was able to get Jay Rockefeller and Evan Bayh to vote for this legislation as well as others, but I was wondering, you think they'd have been there for the president if he really needed those votes?
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't have made the president look good, and the White House had said they'd veto this anyway. But a couple of folks were fence-sitters, like Jim Webb of Virginia. He did support what Murkowski was doing, but said that there's probably a better way, ultimately, to move forward. And the Murkowski camp thought they might have him for a little while. But some of those Democrats who came out on her side are from big states of, like, coal-producing places, like West Virginia, where they want to do everything they can to support industry.
Steve, to surprise you, pushed so hard for legislation that eventually would be very difficult to pass,
yeah.
Or as many people say who understand Congress, most bills never pass anyway.
Yeah, that's true. And it would be easy to chalk it up to politics for, I'm grandstanding for the folks back home, it's an election year. But she doesn't really need that kind of help. She doesn't, she's not really facing she's not being threatened, let's put it this way, with losing her job. Not sure what the motive would be here, other than the fact that to take her at her word and say that she says that this is going to be difficult on small businesses to have the EPA regulating greenhouse emissions, and it would impact states like Alaska. It'd have a great impact on our state. So that's why she's taking up this cause.
Thank you. Steve, or Brother Paul, I'm wondering, doesn't this move to limit the EPA seem at odds with the national mood? I mean, given what's happened in the Gulf and the accident in West Virginia where the miners were killed, where it seems like the mood of the American public is we need more regulation, not less.
I think that's probably true, and I think that's being used to sell this kind of thing, and it'll be used to sell cap and trade or any other climate legislation. The two, of course, are not linked. I mean, what the Murkowski bill was fighting was a takeover of a bureaucratic declaration of what is versus Congress's job. And I think that that's what she was trying to head off. It really has nothing to do with the oil spill, but it's easy to sell it that way.
Well, that's I'm against bureaucrats.
I'm against bureaucrats.
Okay. Libby, let's get Libby Casey back here. Libby, Washington is talking about former Governor Sarah Palin and her many endorsements. She's been all over the board busily endorsing people. Tell us about some of those endorsements, and particularly one here at home of Joe Miller in the U.S. Senate race.
Yeah, well, she had basically 4 big endorsements over the past week during the primaries that we saw across the country. Nikki Haley, who's running for South Carolina governor, and Carly Fiorina running for U.S. Senate in California were the 2 biggest. And her endorsement of Haley did seem to shoot up her name recognition. Haley still has a runoff, but she came in first on Tuesday. And Carly Fiorina was a surprise to some, and Palin did get a lashback on Facebook initially for endorsing her because Fiorina is more mainstream, not a Tea Party candidate, so to speak. But Palin says Fiorina's pro-life and has a high NRA rating and gave some reasons like that. And Palin says she's watching out for these so-called mama grizzlies, as she puts it. She's, looking out for some of these women candidates out there who are conservative. Now, David Weigel, who writes for the Washington Post about the conservative movement, says there is this rush to find the Palin story in every election when really it may not exist. And he questioned her influence and pointed out, Fiorina had already gotten the endorsement of pro-life groups, so it wasn't a huge risk for Palin. And another endorsement that Palin had, Iowa Governor candidate candidate Terry Branstad was already way ahead in double digits. Palin waited until just a week before the election to endorse him. And Branstad is more moderate than another competitor in that race. He's not a Tea Party guy.
Well, another thing that should be noted, that since I can't make eye contact with you, I have to interrupt you over the phone, is that Branstad had been governor of Iowa four times. It's not like he was unknown.
Right, and Iowa's ground zero for presidential hopefuls and those who want political power, whether as queen makers or queens themselves. So it's sort of a political thing there to do that. Now, she did have one endorsement this past week that did not prevail, a state senator from Arkansas who was running for Congress, and other endorsements she's had in recent weeks have gone off the tracks. Some of the smaller contests, like in an Idaho congressional race. What's interesting, Michael, is we're also seeing Palin used as a negative force. I have a hat tip to give to the Alaska Dispatch, because they have a link to an ad by California gubernatorial candidate Jerry Brown, who's using footage of Palin on Fox criticizing him. And he says, fight back against what they're calling these right-wing extremists and support me, send me money.
So Jerry feels that that'll help him? Is that how this works?
Absolutely, because in the ad, Palin's saying, he did this wrong, he did that wrong, and his people say that's not true. He actually lowered, he did not raise taxes when he was governor prior, yada, yada, yada. So they're using her as a tool for their own purposes.
Okay, what about the endorsement of Joe Miller?
That's right. It's raised some eyebrows down here in Washington. Joe Miller, Fairbanks attorney, who is running against U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski on the Republican ticket. And Palin came out on Facebook and endorsed him and said that, on really her Facebook page, which is a national profile, that she thinks that good competition is healthy for democracy. Although to those in the Murkowski camp, that's got to seem like a bit of a stab. Why go to the trouble to get involved in this race when the two have sort of had tough relations in the past? And there are questions about if Palin makes a national size endorsement like that, will it bring in money for Joe Miller?
Steve McDonald, you had a thought.
It did surprise me that she would do that. I know that they've had their differences, and speaking of Senator Murkowski and former Governor Palin, but it seemed like they had patched things up at one point. And I think Palin either at least planned or had a fundraiser for Lisa Murkowski a while back. So I was kind of surprised that she waded into the race, and certainly surprised that she decided to endorse Miller. I was surprised about that.
Paul Jenkins.
Well, I think it's part of the storied Palin vindictiveness that Lisa Murkowski, when the former governor resigned, stood up in front of cameras and said, I'm sorry she abandoned her constituents, abandoned Alaskans, and I think that rankled her. And she did give her $5,000, she says, to assure everyone she wasn't going to run against her. Okay. But I think there have probably been other slights along the way, and this is her way of saying, howdy.
Yeah, that was certainly a hot and heavy room for a long time. A lot of speculation that she, Sarah Palin, would run against Lisa Murkowski at some point.
Well, especially right at the beginning after Palin achieved national prominence.
Right, yeah. Right.
And Paul, does she then go door to door for Joe Miller or what? Come on.
I don't know. I'm not sure it helps Joe Miller up here. I'm really not. So I she would probably, if she would help him in any way, she'd probably be doing TV ads.
That's a good question, though, too. I'd like to find out how active she's going to be in the gubernatorial race. Is she going to come up to the state and campaign, one would presume, for Sean Parnell?
Is there any way to ask this besides sending her a Twitter or a tweet?
Or put it on my Facebook page. If you've seen Sarah, please ask her that. I don't know. You're just going to have to hopefully bump into her at some point.
Let's get Libby Casey back in here from Washington. Libby, has Washington, D.C., the chattering class back there, settled on an interpretation of what Sarah Palin is up to?
Well, I think that's the big question. And so as we watch her endorsements, people are reading the tea leaves and saying, what does it mean if she endorses a shoo-in candidate in Iowa who's not that conservative of a Republican? Does that mean she's trying to get in the party's good graces? And then when she goes ahead and endorses a Tea Party candidate, does that mean she's trying to work with the Tea Party folks? Or is she truly just following her own, her own instincts and spirit of who she believes are good candidates? I think when you make a move in any kind of Iowa race, people start speculating. But I think right now, she's viewed as someone who has not put politics aside. Whether or not she has any sort of presidential aspirations, she is not stepping aside and leaving politics anytime soon. She is getting involved. She recorded these like robocalls for Carly Fiorina and Nikki Haley. She's still making announcements and appearances across the country at conservative events. So this talk, when she resigned nearly a year ago, is she going to recede into the background? I think the answer is firmly no.
Okay, let's stay with you, Libby. Speaking of Sarah Palin, she sent President Obama a little note the other day saying if you needed any help dealing with oil spills, just call me.
Yeah, she's the girl, yeah, to deal with this. On Facebook, she announced that if the president wanted some help, she, you know, he could give her a call. Because President Obama said the other day that he has not talked to or met with BP's CEO, Tony Hayward, and that did raise some eyebrows. Why are the two not talking? So Palin blasted that and said that the president should be reaching out to folks like that. And, in fact, since he should have executive-level experience, you learn as, you know, governor of a state like Alaska that you have to talk to the folks on the ground, especially from industry. And she recommended he give people in Alaska a call who dealt with Exxon Valdez, including perhaps herself. Now, I don't know if that's taken seriously by anyone, but it definitely shows that she certainly considers herself to be a player in all these events.
Yeah, I was interested to note the New York Times had a front page story on Friday about lawyers who had experience in Alaska who are getting involved in the Louisiana lawsuits that are burgeoning as we speak. Mm-hmm. Okay, Alaska legislators don't like the Denali kid care veto, but there's not really quite much they can do about it. Steve, are you surprised? What are the legislators saying, and have you been surprised by it?
No, and this is, we talked a few moments ago about this being a political season. I think this is all part of the political season. You've had Senator Hollis French of Anchorage, who's a candidate for governor and hopes to win his party's nomination and go toe-to-toe with Governor Parnell in November. He called for a special session to consider overriding the veto of money that was destined for Denali Kid Care. He's asked the Senate president to begin polling members of the Senate to see if there's any kind of will there to hold a special session. There's not a lot of optimism that this is going to come to fruition. The Senate leaders say, I don't think it's going to happen. Not a lot of will there. You know, it's the middle of the summer. This is, again, a campaign season, so people who are running for re-election aren't going to want to leave the campaign trail. This, I think, is a done issue. I think that Governor Parnell vetoed this money because of it being a political season, and I do think all these protests are also in part due to the fact that Election Day looms.
And there are some Republican legislators who voted for this bill and wanted it.
Right. There's a lot of people. Obviously, the legislature approved this thing, right? That's why the governor decided to veto it. So it was approved by the legislature in the first place. And now everybody's kind of like, well, yeah, I kind of have second thoughts about it now, kind of thing. Well, so there's a lot of hemming and hawing over the whole thing right now. The governor, of course, vetoed this because he said he found out much later. The governor, by the way, was in favor of this money going into Denali Kid Care in the first place. But then later he said he found out that some of this money would be used for abortions, and therefore that's why he vetoed it.
Paul?
Well, some of the legislators who voted for it are saying the same thing. Yeah. Well, I didn't know that.
I only work here.
I only voted for it. No, and that's what it comes down to. He hit it on the head. It's political season. People do what they have to do in the next couple of months, and this is it. This is one of the things
Steve,
they have to do.
Much try hitting this one. How did this become so contentious? I mean, from the very name, which is designed to suggest we're trying to help kids, and the fact that, as I understand it from the reporting, that we're talking about less than one half of 1% of the money goes to something like that's called abortion-related services, which may also include education of some kind.
Well, let's not let the facts down in the way of a good campaign.
The whole thing blew up.
Yeah, it did. Well, I just think you've got a guy like Parnell who is basically mopping the floor with everybody at this particular point in time. If you put credence in the polls, and I do, because there's, you know, we've got some pretty reputable pollsters here in Alaska, and Dave Dittman's got a poll out there that shows that Dittman's way ahead of everybody. Sorry, Parnell's way ahead.
He believs
everybody.
He's way ahead.
Yeah, Dittman's way ahead too. I'm voting for David. But anyways, it's a Dittman poll. You know, shows that Parnell's way ahead, and Parnell very strong on the campaign trail right now. So these guys are looking for anything. So this was an opening, and how can you, Ethan Berkowitz, who's also running for governor on the Democratic side, he said, he approved money to fix up the governor's mansion and took money away from Alaska's kids. You know, it's an emotional issue. It's a mom and pop
issue. Somebody was looking for that comparison and found it.
Yeah.
Look what I found.
Yeah. So it's just, this was served up on a platter for his opposition.
And the Republicans who are running against Governor Parnell are in the tough position of saying, after weeks of saying how wrong he is, and they have to say, and I.
Oh, but they do it nicely. They say, well, you know, I'm not sure about that, but he should have cut more out of the Capitol.
That's right. That's exactly what was said.
Can we just change the subject here? Yeah, their
approach. Can't we move on?
Yeah. Yes, can't we move on? Libby, both Lisa Murkowski and Frank Begich are supposed to come up or expected to come up with bills dealing with the BP oil spill. Can you tell us what that legislation looks like as they're shaping it?
Yeah, Senator Murkowski has introduced a bill that would start a compensation office to help expedite BP victims getting paid, and the government would get reimbursed from BP. And she says that's to keep folks from waiting years, as happened with claims in the Exxon Valdez spill. And then next week, she's going to come out with some more legislation, and here's a preview of what it seems to look like. She wants to set a criteria to determine oil spill liability based on things like a company's safety record or the drilling conditions or the depth. And she says that the president or the administration could decide on a case-by-case basis what an appropriate liability limit is. So if it's a big company that's doing deep water drilling, the president or the administration could set a higher liability limit. She'd also like to boost the oil spill liability trust fund, and that means increasing the tax on the barrels of oil that companies ship out. And Senator Begich is working on his own legislation, too, that's in the works. He wants BP to put money in an escrow account to cover cleanup costs and compensation, and he wants to increase the financial liability for oil companies and also boost that oil spill liability trust fund. Another idea he has is to use the regional citizens advisory commissions, like were started after the Exxon Valdez, as a model for other places. And this is giving him both a chance to sort of dust off some things they've introduced before and re-present them to the Senate. For example, for Begich, he's saying, well, hey, this is the perfect time to do oil spill prevention specifically to the Arctic. And Murkowski's bringing up revenue sharing for Alaska, saying Alaska should get more money from offshore drilling than it presently does.
Okay, thank you very much. The Daily News yesterday carried a story, and there were stories all over the country, about the BP plan for dealing with the disaster in the Gulf or a blowout, which showed that it was wildly inaccurate. For one thing, a number of people who were to be contacted were dead or had taken new jobs. And in some cases, they referred to what they were going to do with the walruses and the sea lions. Steve, how could this possibly happen, and should people here in Alaska be looking at the response plans here?
I think so, absolutely. And they had a fellow who was a professor from the University of Miami who was supposed to be a specialist in wildlife biology. Problem is, he died in 2005, so he's not going to be much help right at this point. They were saying things like, you know, we were going to analyze and protect, the walrus rookery in the Gulf of Mexico.
The danger here is suggesting that you either didn't take it seriously or you've made yourself into a joke for John Stewart and others like that.
Absolutely, and it just feeds this notion and it's evidence, actually, that they're making it up as they're going along. And the other component in this, though, is that this plan goes before government regulators for approval. So one would assume that they read this report and signed off on it, including the part about the walruses in the Gulf of Mexico.
So that sounded like somebody's safe recall just got out of control. Went to an Alaska plan and put it in there.
Yeah, they got a plan. It looks really long. It's 500 pages. It must be good. Click.
Boring.
It was just it just feeds into the notion that BP is making this up as it goes along, and it's not just this oil company. It's also the federal regulators who are supposed to be overlooking this industry. There's some real problems here, and it's really unfortunate that you have to have a disaster like this or a disaster like the Exxon Valdez to point out the shortcomings in this system, and there's going to be a lot of soul searching.
Paul, thank you, Steve. Paul, what is the fate, take a look at, of the BP stock?
It's been beaten like a red-headed strip show. They took a 16% drop on Wednesday, recovered by Thursday, in the overall picture from the day before the spill happened. BP stock was selling for $58.86, and just before I came here today, it was $33.72. Should be noted that the book value of BP, and that's its hard assets, wells, trucks, desks, that kind of thing, the hard value, forget the people, forget the product, is $33.25. Mm. So basically the stock is trading for about what the hard stuff is worth in the company. And it's not a good sign. That shows a real lack of
And the fiscal
confidence.
financial analysts I've heard talk about that the value of the company is
That's
still
right.
very high.
It's still very high. It's a very valuable company. That's correct.
Let's get Libby in here for one more round. Libby, Don Young's comments on the spill are making the round once again in Washington and all over the country. Remind us, what our congressmen have to say and what are people saying about him?
Right. In late May, the congressman told APRN that he doesn't consider the spill in the Gulf to be a disaster. He said it's not an environmental disaster and that it's a natural phenomenon to have oil seepage in the ocean. And that, you know, this is not a natural catastrophe. It looks bad. It's no fun to see. Some birds will be lost. But overall, the environment will recover. He says it's a tragedy because human lives were lost. But his denial that it's an environmental disaster raised the hackles of a lot of environmental groups and also the folks who are running against him this fall in his reelection bid took a real shot at him and said, you know, how can he not call it a disaster? This is a huge catastrophe, exactly the opposite of what he said. And it's really making the rounds. It's been on the Huffington Post. It's been all over different news outlets. It's been in the New York Times even. So while Alaskans may have heard him say things like that before, it seems to be creating a stir nationally.
We got to get out of here. We can't make the rounds anymore. Good night.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.